What? Let's see.
Okay. These are all different things. dx squared, d of x squared, d squared x. This notation of the d's, d stands for the Latin word differentia. We call them differentials now. Goes back to Leibniz. He invented the notation. All right. We still use the notation today. What do these things mean? What's the difference between them? Right. If you see these kind of things in your calculus or differential equations class, or you're teaching calculus and these things come up. What is the difference between these things?
The first one, the square of the derivative of x.
Square of the differential of x, but yeah. Okay.
The derivative, the second derivative of x squared, the differential of x squared.
Yeah. Maybe I should brief. Okay. Yeah, okay, so this is, yeah. Okay, the differential of x squared is the second one. And then what's that?
The second differential of x?
Yeah, the differential of the differential. Okay? Now, the understanding of differentials is just, it's an infinitely small change in x. Right? I think to understand these things, it's helpful to think of, say, an actual sequence of numbers and actual differences. Okay. So, for example, right, let's say we just have x is, we have a sequence of numbers. How about x0 is 0, x1 is 1, x2 is 2, and so on. Right? And we're just going to look at differences between them, okay? So you could, of course, square all these things. Okay, so just look at non-negative integers, very simple thing. The book uses the notation of the Greek delta, the lowercase delta, the curly one that's kind of like an S. Right, so you take differences of terms, adjacent terms in the sequence, right? Let's have the sequence go out a little further. Differences of the squares is 1, 3, 5s. One, three, five, seven, nine, etc. The odd numbers. Right? That corresponds to this one. It doesn't correspond to this one. Whereas, on the other hand, if we just work with the original sequence, right, the delta x is always 1. Right? And then if we squared those, right, we would just get more 1s. So it depends on what you take the difference first, you square first. And then here, this, understanding the context of second differences. A difference of differences, right? If you have a sequence and you take differences of consecutive terms, you get another sequence. So maybe I'll use a different letter. How about sequence of cube numbers. One, 8, 27, 64, 125, 216, 343, 5, then we take differences of terms. 7, 19, 37, 61, 91, nine cubes. 217. Second differences. 12, 18, 24, 30, 36, 42. Let's see, 48. Third difference is right, why not? 6, 6, 6, 6. Fourth difference is less interesting. 0, 0. So Leibniz was motivated by the idea of considering differences of sequences, and then the inverse operation, right, of differences of sequences is you add up sequences, right? Like with these cubes, instead of taking a difference, What if we started adding terms together? Okay, so just start with 1 and add the 8, add the 27. You get 36. Maybe I should, not sure what the best notation is. Let's see here. I guess it should start out like there, right? If you want, you could imagine it starting with 0, where you sum nothing. Right? Okay, then add the first term, then add the second term. Now 9 and 27 is 36, 36 and 64 is 100, 100 and 125 is 225, 225 and 216 is 441. It's not a coincidence they're all perfect squares. 729. Did I get that right? No. 784. Which is 28 squared. And the idea just keeps going. 1296. 36 squared. Could add that one. 1996, 2016, 2025. Okay. And the thing you notice here, right? is that if you take differences, right, of this kind of accumulation sequence where you're adding up the terms from another sequence, the differences undo the summation. Now, Leibniz. Leibniz was considering this kind of stuff. He wasn't doing it with cubes, but he was doing it with reciprocals. Saw these kinds of patterns. Okay. Thank you. This, if you repeatedly take these differences, what you get is this thing called the harmonic triangle. Point is the summations and the differences, they undo each other, right? Like here, two deltas and a sigma, the delta and the sigma, they cancel out, so to speak, right? Like here, and here, you could imagine three deltas, right? Put a sigma in there somewhere. Or maybe you have something even crazier like this. Four deltas and two sigmas, right? Some of them cancel out. Right? These operations undo each other. And here, the differences. It's getting a little bit more annoying due to the fraction. Yeah, like this one, a little bit more annoying. The least common multiple of 12 and 20 is 60. So you do this in terms of 60ths, and it's 5/60 minus 3/60, which is 2/60, which is a 30th. Right? And get even more annoying, this one. Anyways. Harmonic triangle. Okay. The summation and differences undo each other. I think it's a little bit easier to see what's going on with something less fraction arithmetic going on. So Leibniz says, okay, what if, we have, instead of a sequence with actual discrete jumps, we imagine an infinitely long sequence of x values that change by infinitely small amounts. What does this infinitely long sequence business mean, right? It's not going to be precisely defined, right? Nor is infinitely small. Thank you. So the notation then, you imagine, say, like e.g., imagine, like, if say we have, say, this sequence of cubes, but we allow, instead of just taking values of integers, we look at, imagine a sequence of x and y values, where the y value is always the cube of the x value, but now that, and these big differences, right? And then, let's see here, that's supposed to be a delta there. So the delta and the sigma correspond now to these concepts. Right? I mean, Leibniz, of course, wants to write in the learned language of the time, right? So everyone in Europe can know. He uses Latin words, differentia, summa, right? This is just a German form of an S, just like this. That's a Greek S, this is a German S. Just means sum, add them up. Okay. So he has this, so that's how Leibniz sees the fundamental theorem of calculus. Differences undo sums, sums undo differences. Right, so you could imagine, you think of the fundamental theorem of calculus, it's like this. Here's how he sees the connection between area and tangents. He's thinking in terms of tiny changes, right? I mean, you can understand that, really tiny sequence. Differences are infinitely small. There's infinitely many terms in the dot 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 there, whatever that means, right? And so now, and of course, like the y dx, right? Let's say there's, for example, the cube function. Terms in the dot dot dot. Okay? And so now if we're integrating this, what do I call z integral of y dx, right? Well then your initial term, will be they're small, right? I guess start with nothing, then add the first term. And add the second term. You get to the last one, you're going to have all of those terms added up. There's all of it. So you have infinitely many infinitely small terms added up, whatever that means. There's always infinitely many terms lurking in the dot dot. But it should still come out finite, right? Because they're, or you hope, right? Because each term, although there's infinitely many, they're each infinitely small. Not exactly a rigorous idea here, but then we think, okay, so let's call W the differential of the sum. We use the word integral instead of sum now. What would happen here, right? First difference. Difference between these two is just minus one, x one. Then we take the difference of the next two. And you just get, the difference between these two is just y2 dx2. So if you're thinking about it in terms of these not clearly defined infinite sequences, infinitely small things, this seems trivial, right? So of course, then you think in terms of slope a tangent line, right? Well, right? Not dw, dz, right? dz, right, is the w there, right? Well, what do you have? You have, I claim you have y. Right? Because here you have, W1 is that, from the sequence there, you have these differentials. Right? Actual differences of and sums from actual sequences. Now this seems trivial, right? So of course the derivative undoes the integral. That was good. Just to be clear, W is the dz right there. So. Okay. And you could go the other way, right, and see that the integral undoes a differential. Have any sequence values.
And this is the way, you know, when you actually teach calculus in a semi-rigorous fashion, you probably, you know, give examples with the Riemann sums. Yeah, we cut the area under the curve up into these thin rectangles, right? With height y and width, you know, some small number, delta x or dx, whatever we call it, right? The Leibniz, you know, just thinks, okay, you've got infinitely many, infinitely thin rectangles, and you're adding them up. And of course, the difference as you go from one to the next will just be the area of that one thin rectangle, right? The last one, right? If you stop there. At any point, wherever you stop, you get that difference. And then if you divide by the dx, because you're interested in a tangent line slope for your area, slope of the curve of your area function, you recover the height function. So Leibniz thinks more fundamentally in terms of just adding stuff up, getting subtotals from adding up the initial segment of the sequence versus taking differences of consecutive terms of the sequence. Then, you know, he gives it the natural geometric interpretation. You know, you can interpret this as an area in the usual Riemann sum way. A bunch of thin rectangles, areas added up. Then we can do this ratio here and interpret it as the slope of the tangent line. But for him, it's fundamentally about these tiny differences and then adding up infinitely many tiny differences. So, because Leibniz is thinking in terms of differences and sums of sequences instead of in terms of motion, like Newton was, you know, Leibniz will, you know, discover, you know, a lot of overlapping facts that Newton also discovered, but he also discovers some different things that you don't see in Newton. And Newton discovers lots of stuff that Leibniz didn't figure out, of course. Newton is the one that comes up with Newton's laws for physics and so on, you know, inverse square law for gravity to explain Kepler's laws of planetary motion. Leibniz didn't invent, a lot of people say, you know, Newton invented physics, what we call modern physics. Leibniz didn't make the same level of contributions to physics. Make some. A lot of times I actually like the Leibnizian, you know, way of thinking more. Of course, if I have to justify this stuff, I'm going to end up talking about limits. If you want to justify it, the only way to avoid talking about limits is you have to go beyond the real number line, do something called hyperreals, which was figured out in the 1960s. Does is, you know, he figures out the product and quotient rules. Newton would do everything in terms of a particular power series, right? You know, power series for this, power series for that. So for Newton, everything's a polynomial. So he doesn't ever really need to consider things like product rules and quotient rules, because everything he's dealing with is a polynomial. You can always, when you're multiplying polynomials, you can always distribute the terms
another polynomial.
But Leibniz, with his differentials, considers things a little more abstractly, right? You have something here, x and y, and x and y don't have to be a power series for things to make sense. Leibniz used power series too, as we'll talk about in a bit, but a lot of his thinking isn't limited to power series when you think in terms of these differences. So of course, Leibniz, we're going to think, instead of, the fluxion, right, so the putting dots, I'm thinking of the speed of x, y, right, in terms of the speed of x and the speed of y. We're going to talk about the differential. Tiny change in x times y. Okay, so what is this? Well, you want to think of change in x times y. So, okay, imagine x and y change a little bit. Okay, so there's a little tiny change in x. That represents whatever the change in x is. That represents whatever the change in y is. And then you multiply them to get the new value. And you subtract the old value. You could imagine this as a sequence. This is, term k of the sequence. Right? You take the k minus one term. It would look like this. Actual sequence of x and y's, and you multiply the sequences together term by term like this. Right? If the k, if you take the difference between terms k and k minus 1, right, you could add that difference back if you want to express this term in terms of the previous term plus the difference. Now, of course, it's simpler to just suppress the subscripts, right? And for Leibniz, if you do this with the sequences, you cancel this stuff, what are you going to get? You do the distributive law, and then cancel out the x, y term. Right? You'll have x times y here, it gets canceled. So you'll end up with, y times dx, which is easier to read if I write the letters. How can I write this? Let's write this, and then, okay. So after you use the distributive law, mnemonic device, subtract the x times y, that's what you have left. Likewise here, what do you have left? You have dxk times y k minus 1 plus x times dy k plus dx k times dy k. Now, what you want to... You might be worried with a sequence, I've got all these... Not all the indices are going to quite match. But the idea is that the differences should be infinitely small. Okay. So the difference between the k minus one term in the sequence and the kth term in the sequence, like this, this difference is infinitely small. This difference is infinitely small. So this thing here. You could just like this. I mean, what's the difference between this term and this term? It's a dxk times a dyk difference. What's the difference between this term and this term? Well, it's a dxk times a dyk difference. And then what's the difference between this term and nothing? Another dxk times dyk difference. Okay? But, you know, if you have something infinitely small times something of normal size, and then you have something else like this, which is infinitely small times another infinitely small thing, that's infinitely smaller. Like, if you have 1/1,000 times 1/1,000, that's 1/1,000,000, which is a lot smaller than 1/1,000. So, the idea is that there'll be different levels of smallness, and you only need to care about the stuff at the highest level. Right? Okay. You can see here the business with the subscripts really doesn't matter, right? Because you can always change the subscript by one, and the effect is infinitely small compared to the end result. So you don't have to worry about, you know, exactly how it works out with sequences. So you can just leave it like this. You might want to write it sometime. Well, the alignments just drop all that other stuff. And this is the way Leibniz likes to write the. This is the way he'd like to write the rule. Right? Take this term, put it here, put it there. So, you know, do a similar thing. And with a quotient rule. You'll notice that here, you know, we haven't explicitly written it in terms of derivatives, right? If we wanted, say, the derivative of, you know, this with respect to x, you know, and we could do it, it's easy. Or maybe you want a derivative with respect to something totally different. Right? Maybe x and y depend on time t. Right? Then it would look like this. Which, you know, that this is the kind of thing, you know, see the product rule written like this. Usually we write the rule usually the way I write the product rule in calculus courses, I put it the other way. With differentials, it's usually less confusing if you put the differential term at the end of a product, so that it's clear, okay, I'm taking the differential of x as opposed to the differential of x times y. Less chance of a misunderstanding, so let's put it over there.
Or a quotient.
If you don't worry about actually, you know, giving a rigorous interpretation to all this infinitely small business, you know, which also goes by the name infinitesimal, you know, and this is, you know, just some algebra. The only trick is to recognize when something is infinitely smaller than something else, so you know what to throw away. You have an x times a y canceled with another x times a y. You have y times dx right there minus x times dy. And then down here is that. That doesn't look quite like our quotient rule. But I claim you can neglect that last term there. Why? Well, think of it like this. Forget about the numerator, right? Just think of it as this, the reciprocal of this times the numerator, right? What's the difference between these two things? If you bring these terms together, you'll get this. Multiply this by a y on top and bottom. Multiply this by a y plus dy on top and bottom. Take the difference, and you get this. So this is infinitely small. Okay? So you can just if you make a change right from here to here, the change will be this infinitely small quantity times that numerator y dx minus x dy. So the difference between these two things is infinitely small compared to either side of the equation. You've got, you know, already, both sides are already infinitely small. You know, you've got y times an infinitely small dx, and the numerator is, you know, not infinitely small. Or sorry, denominator is not infinitely small. So already both sides are infinitely small, but the difference is, you know, doubly infinitely small, right? Because it'll be this thing, this infinitely small thing here, times an infinitely small numerator, so it'll be infinitely smaller. So there's just this trick of recognizing, oh, something is infinitely smaller than something else. And of course, you can compare to our quotient rule.
long as you're willing to just throw away relatively infinitely small things, then all this stuff in calculus, and you can do it without the limits, and you can just have to reason with these different levels of infinite smallness. And you get the right answer. Of course, later centuries, people were unhappy with mysterious procedures like this. They wanted a firmer understanding of why it works, which is why we define everything usually in terms of limits. Or if you're one of the minority of current mathematicians, you might cook up something called the hyperreals, where you really can have infinitely small things in addition to the regular reals, and define it that way. By far the most common modern approach is to define it in terms of limits. Now, like Newton, Leibniz wanted to justify everything in terms that even the ancient Greeks would accept as like something that could have been a later volume of the elements, justify it all. So Leibniz had this idea of the principle of continuity, which is that, roughly speaking, if you have some algebraic relation like this, then you should be able to say, okay, this will still be true when we make dx and dy arbitrarily small. Right? He thinks of it those terms. It's essentially the limit concept, but in this kind of reasoning, you want to prove the derivative is 2x when you're looking at x squared, right? The Leibnizian way, And Leibniz would say, okay, so I expand the square, I cancel. Say, okay, this relationship, algebraically, this is true for any non-zero dx. It'll still be true if I send dx to zero. Right? Even if the dx is not infinitely small, this is still true. He said, okay, a principle of continuity should still be true when you make dx equal to zero. That doesn't make sense. But things like the slope of the tangent line still make sense. I've actually read some stuff, about people debating, what exactly Leibniz meant by his principle of continuity. Mainly people interested in alternatives to the limit definitions of calculus using things like hyperreals. But whatever exactly he thought, and we don't know exactly how clear all his thoughts were on this stuff, this idea of if something is true for as you're getting close to say zero, at least in some context, it'll still be true when dx is exactly zero. Oh no. Another interpretation of it is along the lines of, okay, this is true for a regular number dx, there's a modern kind of hyperreal interpretation that we should think of this as, he was saying, okay, this is true for regular size, stuff. So by this principle of continuity, we should say this is also true for infinitely small. Leibniz is saying, okay, we have our normal algebra that works for the real numbers. And have our precise concept of real numbers that they think of actual physical magnitudes. We have this algebra that works fine. You imagine just assuming the algebra, like this algebraic fact that we did here, assume it continues to work fine, right? If you sort of just go on beyond the regular size small numbers to these mysterious infinitely small numbers. People have, as I said, starting in the 1960s, cooked up actual models of things called hyperreal lines, where there actually are infinitely small things. And if anything is true for the small real positive numbers, say, then that fact will automatically extend and be true for all of the infinitely small positive hyperreal numbers. I actually tried one semester to teach Calculus 1 here using the hyperreal approach and infinitesimals. It didn't go over well, mainly because people like the tutors would have no idea what I was talking about. This is infinitely small, this is infinitely big, and here's these rules for divide infinitely small stuff by infinitely big stuff, or multiply infinitely big thing times normal size thing divided by infinitely small thing, all this kind of stuff. So just trying to make a Leibnizian thought and Newtonian thought rigorous, that the first sort of success of that came in the 19th century, with the modern epsilon delta definition of limits. Later in the 20th century, as I said, there were other rigorous interpretations of it. This is essentially this is my favorite interpretation of the Leibnizian principle of continuity. He's trying to justify things to the ancient Greeks. He's saying, okay,
if something works for actual finite sequences and finite, you know, sums and differences, then the same facts should extend to some kind of realm of infinitely small differences between terms in infinitely long sequences. So, there's another considers concavity, right? He thinks of it in terms of the sine of the second differential, right? We think of it in terms of the second derivative test. So you're thinking of concave up and concave down, right? So you can imagine a there's x0, x1, x2. We've got some curve. Go up here. Corresponding point, y coordinates. Less cluttered if I move them out of the way. Example of a concave down curve, right? You'll notice that in this picture, you can clearly see that that difference there is smaller than that difference here, right? So if you take the second difference, right?
Yes, sir.
The second difference will be negative. And there's a caveat to this in that I chose, to make this picture work, I chose the dx's to be the same size, right? If I would have made the first dx really, really small, right, then the first dy would have been really, really small, right? And then if the second dx was, you know, this much bigger one, then the second dy would have been actually bigger, okay? So you need these dx's to be the same. So it's kind of implicit in the way I drew it, but I'm making these the same. So if they were constant, then in terms of the second differential, that's zero. Right? So if you choose things, so if you have if you choose your differentials such that you're cutting things up with infinitely small, it's like dx slices, right? So, but of constant infinitely small width, so the second differential is zero, then you get this, you know, what we think of as the second derivatives, you know, test, right? The second differences of the y's coordinates, the second differentials, I should say. If it's a positive thing, it'll be concave up, and then, like in this picture, if it's a negative thing, it'll be concave down. And as you can see, you know, you could imagine, you know, cutting things up in different ways. I mean, maybe in a different application, you know, different context, maybe you would want to cut things up so that the dy's were constant, and then the dx's would not be constant. So Leibniz was actually very flexible in that. He would pick, you know, how he would, you know, sometimes he would say, okay, we're going to cut things up so that the dx's are constant, or such that the dy's are constant. Right? He would do different ones, whether it was convenient, according to what was convenient, right? So, you remember last time we talked about Newton, how he got the power series formula for the sine function. Well, Leibniz also got a power series formula for the sine function, but he did it a different way. So, essentially, this is what he did. He essentially argued that the second derivative of sine has got to be the negative of sine. And then, if you make the what are called, you know, initial conditions, so you say that this sine of 0 is 0 and the derivative of sine at 0 is 1, along with the differential equation that the second derivative is the negative of the original function, then this has a unique power solution, unique power series solution. There's one and only one power series that satisfies this. How did he get the this part? You know, the he's actually thinking of it. You know, think of it geometrically. So we have a circle of radius 1. Okay, so if we use radian measure of angle, say, then you know, let's call this little arc length there theta, call this y, call this x. So what he essentially argues is that the second differential of y there is equal to negative y times d theta squared. And remember, this is the square of d theta. He argues this under the reason, like here, you need this kind of, you have to slice things up so that those x slices have the same width to make for this second derivative test to make sense. So here he slices things up. He imagines slicing up the circle into these sectors where you have equal, infinitely small arc length on each piece. So the d thetas are always the same infinitely small number. Okay. And he just considers in this picture here, you just have to consider what would happen, right, if you had I'll do it in a different color. If you made another triangle, you think of this is supposed to be, you know, infinitely small, but if I draw it infinitely small, you can't see it, of course.
So imagine going a little bit over like that. And what his thinking is, okay, I've got the, I can squeeze it in. So we have the little d theta there. Then you imagine, okay, making the line tangent to the circle right there, which is at a right angle with that radius. Now, okay, so you have that tangent line. There's an infinite, the difference between, you know, this arc of the circle and a little piece of the tangent line is infinitely smaller than the actual lengths of the triangle, right? So we have a little dy here for the that change, right? How is y changing? Well, it increases as we go that way, say. The dx is there as a length, you know, x is actually decreasing as we go this way. Okay. And you have, on the one hand, you have the little arc length there, and on the other hand, you have the tangent line length there. And, you know, geometrically, you know, it looks like, okay, if that's a small angle, you know, the difference between the little bit of tangent line segment versus a little bit of arc length there, you know, the difference in their lengths is infinitely small compared to the actual lengths d theta, dx, and dy involved. And so the key insight here, right, is because you've got a right angle here between the tangent line and this radius, that means that the angle theta right here actually gets copied up here. Actually get it again over there. So, for example, the tangent of theta like this would be that. Because I claim that they're actually similar triangles. Right angle, and here you have that angle theta. You have to have the same angle theta up there again. So here, opposite over adjacent. Sorry, that's small. Draw it again here. Here. Supposed to be similar triangle. Yeah. So you have this relationship, and then you also have the Pythagorean theorem, right? These are all right triangles. So, I mean, here you have a dx squared plus dy squared equals d theta squared. Here you have x squared plus y squared equals 1. Can do is you can put all these together, right?
You just have to take another derivative, or differential, I should say. Let's see here. Put these things together. You want to have, okay, so you have dy. You have, if you from this, it, in relation two forms of the tangent, you get that. With this, and we also have to remove others. I think we may also need, differentials of this thing. So we're thinking of this as something squared. And we're assuming the d theta is never change, that they're constant. So that you take that difference. Okay. Ratio would be that. Over there. And then the other thing to deal with is this thing. The easier way to do it.
Okay, I need the other one. Okay, we have a similar triangle. X is to 1 in here as dy is to d theta. Okay. And
because these are both these are also
by similar triangles. This part right here comes from this. That's the wrong idea. Okay, you take this relationship here. I don't think I even need that.
Whatever.
I mean, that's true, but it's not helpful.
You really want this. This equation comes from the fact that dy over d theta is equal to x over 1. And dy is x d theta. And then this equation is from negative dx d theta equal to y over 1.
I guess I don't really need this one.
So if the second differential of the theta is 0, then you do a little rearrangement here. You write this is dx over d theta times the square of d theta. So this is,
you can see, think about this circle, of course, you also clearly see, like right over there, you know, the derivative of sine or y is x or cosine. The opposite of the derivative of x or cosine is sine. Right? So if you think in terms of these infinitesimal triangles, you can prove this stuff very easily. You just have to be willing to make a few, you know, logical leaps, like saying, oh, the difference between the sector length and the little tangent line segment length is small enough to neglect.